Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, and this is episode number 28. Thanks so much for joining me today. Today we're going to talk about guns. We're going to talk about the Second Amendment. We're going to talk about your right to protect yourself and how vitally important that is. Many people look at guns as a negative thing. They look at it as something dangerous. And I just want to propose a new belief system on firearms. Firearms create equality. Think about it. It doesn't matter about physical strength or size or anything like that. When it comes to guns, it equalizes and levels the playing field. And a society where gun ownership is available to the citizens tend not to be oppressed by a government, a totalitarian regime. In history, that's the first thing they do is they make sure the citizens do not have arms. So this is an important topic when it comes to protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in these uncertain times. They say an armed society is a polite society. And my friend Mel, one of our listeners, sent me a bunch of Thomas Jefferson quotes recently. And Jefferson said, "The strongest reason for the people to retain the right to keep and bear arms is as a last resort to protect themselves against the tyranny of their own government." Jefferson also said, "No free man shall ever be debarred from the use of arms." So this is a very important thing, and it's one of the things that really separates America from so many other countries, is that Second Amendment that allows us to protect ourselves. We're going to go to the interview with John R. Lott Jr. He is the author of More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws. And these two are inextricably tied together. I think you'll see that. If you want to know more about the profits element of Holistic Survival, be sure to check out jasonhartman.com and check out the products there in the store. Join us for an upcoming event. We teach people how to create wealth by doing that with income property and with business opportunities, home-based businesses, and we do the properties all around the country, and we've got some phenomenal opportunities where people can earn a projected 10-12% cap rate in some cases and 20%. I mean, I just saw a property yesterday, 20% cash on cash return annually. And just so you know what that means for a moment here, that means the property could go down in value, but as long as you keep it rented and have that income and keep your expenses in check, you would have a 20% cash on cash return. You simply cannot do that in any other asset class, because income property is a multi-dimensional asset class and has such unique, special characteristics that are not offered in anything else. So check out jasonhartman.com, our properties, our products, properties in 43 markets nationwide. I think you'll really like what we have to offer there. And let's go to the interview with John R. Lott right after this quick message. We'll be back with him in less than 60 seconds.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn how to finance your next big real estate deal, there's a show for that. If you want to learn more about food storage and the best way to keep those onions from smelling up everything else, there's a show for that. If you honestly want to know more about business ethics, there's a show for that. And if you just want to get away from it all and need to know something about world travel, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com, or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
My pleasure to welcome John R. Lott to the show. He is the author of More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws. John, you've written a great piece here, and you've got several books, and it's great to have you on the show and talk about this all-important topic to our freedom as Americans. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Talk to us, if you would, John, about the effects of gun control on crime. We've seen recently Australia, England, other places you hear around the world, cities in the U.S. where they become very restrictive on the gun laws. And you know the old saying, when you outlaw the guns, only the outlaws have the guns, and they know the people are defenseless. What really happens in practice out there with these gun control laws?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I mean, we all want to try to take guns away from criminals. The problem that you face with gun control laws generally is who's most likely to obey the laws. And if you pass a law, let's say something like a ban for a simple case, and it's the law-abiding good citizens who turn in their guns, but not the criminals, you can actually have very perverse results there, that rather than making it safer for the victims, you may unintentionally make it safer for the criminals, who have less to worry about in terms of victims being able to defend themselves. And one thing that I hope people take away from this edition of the book, as the third edition that just came out, as well as other work that I've done, is that if you look around the world, every time that we've had a handgun ban go into effect, there's been increases in murder rates. So if you were to go and debate somebody about gun control, I would just ask them to point to one place where we've had a gun ban and murder rates have gone down, because I can't find it. Americans are generally familiar with what's happened in Washington, D.C. and Chicago, about how when those bans were put in place, we saw huge explosions in murder rates in both of those cities. And some people may know that since 2008, when the Supreme Court struck down the D.C. gun ban and their gun lock requirements, we've seen about a 30% drop in murder rates since then. Murder rates now are back below where they were before the ban. But what they may often think is that, well, you know, Washington, D.C. and Chicago are just special cases, that gun control laws really couldn't work too well. Some gun control proponents will claim here in the United States, because even though you have bans in Washington, D.C. and Chicago, unless you have a ban every place, criminals can go and get guns from other places in the country and put it in. I guess I have two responses to that. One is, if they thought it was somehow destined to fail, it would have been nice for them to tell everybody before they pushed for the bans to begin with. But secondly, as I say, if you look around the world, it's just not in the United States that you see these increases. And whether it's whole countries that have passed bans, or whether it's island nations which have passed it, which presumably have relatively easy to defend borders, you see increases in murder rates and violent crimes, and never see a drop in murder rates or violent crimes generally after these bans go into effect.
That's an interesting point. I remember, I think it was an economics professor I had in college who actually did this, and I'm not sure why it came up in econ class, but he told everybody to move to one side of the room or another based on their thoughts about gun control. So on one side of the room were the people that think there should be no guns, they should be completely illegal, and on the other side there were people that think that there should be very little gun control. And then he presented this, and when you said that issue about how criminals can move about, of course, and they can bring guns into an area. They can bring them in from Mexico. The drug cartels are bringing them from the U.S., I guess, and it's going both ways. But other states, so when you take a place like Chicago or Washington, D.C. or something, you can just bring them from the neighboring areas. And he said, how many of you would be in favor of gun control if within 10 years we could really, really clean up the guns and completely eliminate them from our society? If that were possible, how many of you would be in favor of outlawing guns completely? I don't think that's possible, is it, John? I mean, it's a big world, and that's a utopian, idealistic dream, right? That could never happen.
I mean, you know, we've seen countries around the world go and try to ban guns completely, and with little success. I mean, during the 1970s and 1980s, the former Soviet Union had a murder rate that was about someplace between about twice and five times higher than the murder rate that we had in the United States over the same period of time. And yet, you know, they've supposedly banned guns for 70 years. And you see other countries which have tried to go and ban guns. And one of the things that they learn is that a lot of gun crime is related to drug gangs. And just as you can't stop the drug gangs from going and smuggling in illegal drugs into their country, they can't stop them from smuggling in weapons. And drug gangs, if one drug gang tries to invade another drug gang's turf, it's not like they go and call up the police and say, could you go and get this other gang to leave our area? This is our area. What they do is they set up their own little militaries, essentially, to protect their turf. They have very valuable product there with the drugs.
And just as they're going to spend a lot of effort to bring the drugs in, they're going to spend effort to go and make sure that they have the weapons to protect those valuable drugs. And I don't think you're going to be any more successful or have been any more successful in stopping illegal drugs coming in or, you know, illegal guns than they've been so far. I mean, you may want to try to ban those things, but as England and Jamaica and other places which have, you know, our island nations, which have banned guns, they have huge drug gun problems.
Just as an aside, and I know this is not really the topic, but since you mentioned it, the war on drugs has been pretty much a miserable failure. In fact, it's empowered the business of drug running. What are your thoughts on drugs and the legalities there, if you have thought much about it? You kind of give the parallel to the guns, and that's why I thought I'd ask.
Right. No, sure. Well, I mean, I've thought a lot about it. I guess I have some mixed thoughts on it. But you know, most people don't know that the highest murder rate that we've ever had in the United States was in 1933. And then the murder rate fell fairly dramatically by about 6% within 2 years after that. And the reason why 1933 was the highest murder rate because it was the last year of prohibition, that mob groups or others that controlled alcohol distribution in different areas would fight against each other to be the ones who would be able to sell alcohol in a particular area. It was basically the formation of organized crime. And as soon as alcohol was legalized, there was no longer any incentive to go and try to fight against each other to control that turf. And so we saw this big drop in murder rates. It was basically until you get to the mid to late 60s when we started the war on drugs with Vietnam and a lot of illegal drugs coming into the country again, you began to see the big increase in violent crimes and murders again. Even during the 1990s, one of the reasons why we had the big drop in violent crime during the 1990s was because of changes in how we did drug enforcement at the beginning of the decade. Towards the end of the Cold War and after the Cold War, our military had been used a lot for drug interdiction. And basically, only the largest drug cartels were able to have the resources to go and bring drugs into the country. And so what that meant is you basically had relatively few suppliers that controlled the sale of drugs. And so prices of drugs were higher, but it also meant that there were more profits. And after the end of the first Bush administration and the very beginning of the Clinton administration, there were huge cutbacks, almost complete eliminations in many areas of drug interdiction by the military. So you had a lot more drugs coming into the country from a lot more different sources. Prices of drugs fell, but what also fell, just because you had less concentrated industry, was the profits from selling it. And so there was less profits for gangs to go and fight against each other in order to go and control drug turfs in different areas. So I think a lot of the crime over time can be explained or changes by changes in alcohol prohibition or drug prohibition type rules. On the other hand, I think one has to point out that drug use increases when you have lower prices for drugs. Alcohol use increases. And so there's a trade-off. You'll have less crime if you liberalize the rules, but you'll have more usage. And you know, I suppose if you make me have to come down on one side or the other, I'd probably choose the less crime, just because I think the damage in terms of lost lives and other things is even greater. But it's not like nirvana that you can pick from between these things. I think the net benefits are probably greater from liberalizing it, but you know, there's still trade-offs that you face there.
That's a very good analysis, very cogent. It's a lesser of two evils, for sure, but the crime is a larger issue. And in addition to the crime, it's actually sort of just enriching bad people. And that's a negative, too. Instead of enriching people that are doing good things in the world, you're enriching a bunch of criminals.
You know, one of the things that's interesting with regard to crime is I don't think most people realize how geographically concentrated crime is in the United States. If you take something like murder, about 50% of the counties in the United States have zero murders in any given year. About 25% of the counties have one murder. You have about 75% of the murders are in a little bit over 3% of the counties. And if you ever see a map of where murders have occurred over a year in a big city newspaper, you know, sometimes they'll go and have a map that will show you where the murders have taken place. Even within the 3% of the counties, a little bit over 3% of the counties with 75% of the murders, even there, it's very concentrated in very small areas within those counties. So you have almost all the murders, or you know, a huge majority of the murders, just in small places within small places. And that's basically drug gang activity that's occurring in those areas. And the Department of Justice came out with a study last year that indicated that about 80% of violent crime in the United States was gang-related, and that most of that, almost all of that, was drug gang-related. And so it's not just murders, but you also have other types of violent crimes which are associated with that. And, you know, so often when people talk about, well, the United States is a high murder country, what they're really talking about is that there are very small areas within the country where you have all these crimes occurring. And it's really a misnomer to go and talk about kind of the United States as a whole in terms of crime.
That's a very, very good point when you really drill down and you really analyze it. Can you name a few of those counties, by the way? And if it's not a recognizable county name, maybe name the greater metropolitan
area. They're well-known counties. I mean, it's basically the big urban counties. They account for maybe about the 3%, account for about 23% of the population, but they account for about 75% of the murders. And so, you know, you have Chicago, Los Angeles, you know, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., places like that. Basically, the big urban centers, Detroit,
all the usual
suspects,
are
where you have these crimes. But even within there, if you, you know, you look in Los Angeles or New York or D.C., most of those areas, not going to have any murders. And, you know, even though you have a huge number of people living in there, you're going to see the murders are going to be very heavily concentrated. And, you know, you look northwest, you'll be hardly find any murders ever occurring in those places. But you go to southeast or something, you'll find virtually all the murders in the city occurring there. And even then, within just some areas within there.
You know, what's really interesting to me, John, about the gun control arguments, it's generally down the right and left sides of the aisle, whereas the left doesn't want guns and the right wants the right to have guns and Second Amendment. And what's interesting about it is that for some reason, the liberal side of the aisle, the left, has branded themselves as the people who are tolerant and who want equality and all of this kind of stuff, which I think is a complete misnomer, unfortunately, for those on the right, but that's seems to be the association, unfortunately. And what's interesting is that guns are the greatest equalizer. If you have someone who is handicapped, elderly, just between the genders and the strength of the two genders, it makes everybody equal. Because even a little old lady can now protect herself against a big, strong man. And that's equality. It's
yeah,
equal rights.
My research finds pretty much what you're saying, that there are basically two groups of people who benefit the most from having guns. It's people who are relatively weaker physically, women and the elderly, and it's people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime, and that's poor, overwhelmingly poor blacks who live in high-crime urban areas. You know, these are basically people who would normally be thought of as the most vulnerable people in our society, who would benefit from the option to be able to protect themselves. You know, it'd be great if the police were there all the time to protect everybody. My research shows, at least to me, that police are probably the single most important factor for reducing crime. But one thing I think the police understand themselves is that they virtually always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's already been committed. And that raises the question, what do you advise someone to do when they're having to confront a criminal by themselves? And simply telling people to behave passively isn't very good advice. And when you look at the data, you know, women, for example, who behave passively are much more likely to end up being seriously injured or killed than a woman who has a gun. And the benefits, as you say, are much greater for women than for men. And the reason is simple, is that when you're talking about crimes against women, you're almost always talking about a male committing the crime. And there's a larger strength differential that exists there between a man and a woman, where smaller difference between a man attacking a man. And so the presence of a gun represents a much bigger relative change in a woman's ability to go and defend herself than it does for a man. Women who behave passively are about 2.5 times more likely to end up being seriously injured than a woman who has a gun. Men who behave passively are about 1.4 times more likely to end up being seriously injured than a man who has a gun.
That is absolutely accurate. It's unassailable logic. I don't know how anyone could possibly argue with it, which means, logically, no one can argue with it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Just one point you bring up also I think is very interesting. That is the political differences. I've seen multiple polls over the years that when they ask self-identified liberals and conservatives their views on different issues, the one issue that stood out to show the biggest differences between self-identified liberals and conservatives, even more than taxes or abortion, has been the issue of gun control. And it kind of gets in many ways, to the core of issues about whether people have self-defense, do we trust people or not, or do we trust experts to go and do certain things. You know, I think on many of these things, gun control seems to most synthesize kind of the differences in terms of fundamental philosophy between the different groups.
What I was about to say is it just becomes a political issue and just becomes sort of a let's gain power type of thing and buy votes and appeal to illogical conclusions and so forth to get in office, basically. So talk to us, if you would, about the concealed handgun laws and crime rates specifically. It's one thing to own a gun. It's another thing to be able to carry the gun with you on your person, in your car. How do the concealed carry laws impact all of this, and what are the places where you can carry a gun, or you need a permit, or it's really hard to get a permit, and all of the sort of gray there, if you would?
Well, we've had a big change in concealed handgun laws over the last couple of decades. If you go back to the mid-1980s, you would have had maybe a dozen states that would have had right to carry laws. And now we have 40. Right to carry laws are laws where once you meet certain objective criteria, you pass criminal background check, you're a certain age, you pay your fees. About half the states require some type of training. But once you've met those objective criteria and you pass them, if you apply for a permit, then it's automatically granted. And there's only two states that completely ban people carrying permit concealed handguns, and that's Illinois and Wisconsin. Though I expect that Wisconsin's very likely to change, and possibly Illinois after this coming election. But and there are eight states, such as New York and California, New Jersey, Maryland, Hawaii, states like that, which have what we call may issue, which are you have to go and demonstrate some type of need to some public official. So you can say, I feel threatened, I carry large amounts of money with me, I've been a victim of crime before, I'm being stalked or threatened. And then if the public official feels that they view your concern as relatively reasonable or believable, then they'll make a decision whether or not to grant you a permit. And those states may issue, you know, one-tenth as many concealed handgun permits as you'll see in the more liberal right to carry states. Right now, there's probably about 6.2 million people that have concealed handgun permits in the country. That's up fairly dramatically in the last couple of years. We've probably seen about 1.2 million increase in the number of permits over the last couple of years. It's, I think a large part of that's been due to the 2008 election, just like there was a big increase in gun sales right at that time. There was a big increase in concealed handgun permits. And I think there's a lot of evidence from dozens of academic studies that indicate that as the percentage of the population which has concealed handguns goes up, you see drops in murder rates and other violent crimes. My own estimates indicate that for each additional year that you have a right to carry law in effect, you'll see about 1.5 percentage point drop in murder rates and about a 2% drop in rapes and aggravated assaults. Probably the easiest thing, question to go and answer, is just what is the behavior of concealed carry permit holders? And what you find time after time is that these guys tend to be extremely law-abiding by any measure of it. Florida, for example, between October 1987 and May 31st of this year, had given out permits to over 1.8 million people. Many of those had renewed their permits multiple times. Out of those 1.8 million people, 167 had their permits revoked for any type of firearms relation over those 20-some years. And most of those were for very minor offenses, such as accidentally carrying a permit concealed handgun into a restricted area, a gun-free zone. You know, so, you know, maybe one of the more famous examples of something like this would be Barry Switzer, the former coach of the Dallas Cowboys, who was late for a team plane a number of years ago and ran into the Dallas-Fort Worth airport forgetting that he had the permanent concealed handgun on him, and of course he got in trouble for doing that. But nobody, even though the Cowboys were having a bad year, probably nobody thought that he was actually going to do something bad with it. Just when you have a lot of people doing it, every once in a while in a rush, somebody's going to forget that they're not allowed to take a gun into a particular area. And if you look over the last 2.5 years, you've only had three more people in Florida that have had their permits revoked for firearms violation. Over the whole time, you're talking about 1/100th of 1 percentage point And if you're talking about the last 3 years, the rate is really like 1/10,000th of a percentage point of people who have had their permits revoked for a firearms-related violation. And I would argue it's pretty hard to find any other group that's not that's as law-abiding as the type of person who's willing to go through the process to get a permit. If somebody wants to go and commit a crime, they're not going to bother to go through the process of getting a permit.
We'll be back in just a minute.
Now's your opportunity to get the Financial Freedom Report. The Financial Freedom Report provides financial self-defense in uncertain times, and it's your source for innovative, forward-thinking investment property strategies and advice. Get your newsletter subscription today. You get a digital download and even more. Go to jasonhartman.com to get yours today.
That's a very interesting point. Are there any examples that you can think of offhand that a concealed carry citizen saved the day? You hear these awful stories about Columbine. Michael Moore makes a movie with all the wrong conclusions, of course, and people going into McDonald's and shooting them up and all these kinds of things, or the workplace or whatever. And you just know that if some good citizen had their firearm with him, they would have saved many lives.
I mean, there's so many things to bring up on what you just raised there. I just mentioned one thing since you mentioned with Columbine. One of the things I point out in More Guns, Less Crime is that relatively few people know that the day of the Columbine attack, they did it that day because the state legislature was voting on a right to carry law. In fact, the two high schoolers who had engaged in the attack there, one of them had written multiple letters to the state legislature opposing the concealed handgun law and was particularly upset about the provision in the concealed handgun law at the time that would have let people carry permanent concealed handguns on school grounds.
Wow,
and,
really?
So,
that's amazing.
It's kind of amazing to me that that particular thing seems to have, you know, gotten so little attention. It was actually a front page article in the New York Times that actually mentioned that briefly. But just the general notion of news coverage, people without even having to think very hard about these things can recall what seems to be hundreds or thousands of bad stories that happen with guns. But, you know, when was the last time you watched the national evening news and heard a story about somebody using their gun to protect themselves or save others' lives?
You never hear that.
The Department of Justice uses surveys to try to figure out how many crimes occur each year because we know a lot of crimes aren't reported to police. So, for example, we believe that only about half of rapes are reported to police. But how do we figure that out? Well, we have the reported crimes. We know that those are. And they'll go and do these massive surveys. The big survey is something called the National Crime Victimization Survey, where the Department of Justice surveys about 100,000 to 150,000 people each year. And we find that in the case of guns, for example, we have about 250,000 gun crimes are reported to police each year. And they're probably someplace between 400,000 and 450,000, though, you know, the other ones aren't reported above the 250. Well, if you use similar types of surveys to try to find out the rate that people use guns defensively to stop crimes, the average result indicates that it's about 2 million times a year. So that means people use guns to stop crimes about 4 or 5 times more frequently each year than they use to commit them. But very few people would know that because, you know, if anything, they think the ratio is the other way just because they constantly only hear about the bad things that happen with guns and never hear about the benefits. There's multiple websites that have started getting set up. One good one is called keepandbeararms.com, but there are other ones that are there, too. I have some links on my website.
Go ahead and give out your website, if you would, John.
Yeah, my website is just johnrlott.com, johnrlott.com.
Excellent.
And if you just do a find thing on the page for defensive, you'll probably find the link for the defensive gun uses links that I have there.
Let me ask you a question about that, John. You mentioned that the thing about why you really just never hear on the news a story about someone defending themselves with a gun, about any positive news. Why is that? Is it that the news media is just so left-wing liberal, and that's fortunately not as true as it used to be. There are other options nowadays, but why is the big conspiracy to have this whole anti-gun mentality? I mean, it's directly opposite of what our founding fathers had intended.
I actually have a whole book on this entitled The Bias Against Guns. The third edition of More Guns, Less Crime goes into this some, but The Bias Against Guns goes into this a lot more. I mean, first of all, I think you can explain a lot of the coverage without resorting to bias. So let me give you an example. If you're an editor of a news bureau and you have two news stories, in one case, there's a dead body on the ground, a sympathetic person like a victim. In another case, let's say a woman's brandished a gun, would-be attackers run away, no shots are fired, no dead body on the ground, no crime actually committed, you're not even completely sure what crime would have been committed. If you're editor of a news bureau, or if I'm editor, I think any of us would make the decision that the first story with the dead body on the ground is a lot more newsworthy than the second story is going to be. And about 95% or so of the time that people use guns defensively, simply brandishing a gun is sufficient to cause a criminal to go and break off an attack. So that by, and you know, in fact, fewer than one out of every 1,000 times that people use guns defensively is the attacker killed. Woundings are more frequent, but you're still talking about something that's about 7 or 8 times more common than killing the criminal, but it's still just a fraction of 1%. And so, you know, just in terms of kind of if it bleeds, it leads, it's kind of understandable why the vast majority of defensive gun uses don't get covered. That said, there's a lot of things which are hard to explain other than with some type of bias in terms of the media coverage. So, for example, relatively few people know that almost 30% of the public school shootings in the United States, multiple victim public school shootings, have been stopped by citizens with guns before the uniformed police were able to arrive. And the reason why most people won't know those types of things is because when a citizen stops a multiple victim public shooting at a school, only about 1% of the news stories will mention that that was the case. If a police officer stops a shooting, you'll find about 34% of the news stories will mention that the how it stopped by a police officer doing it. So, you know, I'll just give you a couple of examples, but you look at the very first of the public school shootings in Pearl, Mississippi in October 1997, in which two students were killed. You had an assistant principal there at the school, a guy named Joel Myrick, a former Marine, who had a permit to carry a concealed handgun. And apparently he regularly carried his permit concealed handgun with him on school property up until the end of 1995 when the Federal Safe School Zone Act was passed, banning guns within 1,000 feet of a school, unless you have the state legislature specifically passing exemptions for concealed carry holders. And so being a good law-abiding citizen, he would lock his gun in his car and park his car more than a quarter of a mile off of school property every morning when he got there. When the attack started, he literally had to run a half mile to get his gun a half mile back, and he held the attacker on the ground for about 5 minutes at point-blank range before the police arrived. The attacker was just in the process of leaving the high school to go to the middle school across the street where he was going to continue his attack. And if you do what's called a nexus search, any lawyers will know what this is, but it's basically a computerized news service where you have computerized records of all the different news stories, TV shows, other things from around the country. And you'll find in the 1 month after that attack about 687 separate news stories about the incident. Of those 687, 19 mentioned the assistant principal in any way. 13 of the 19 mentioned that the assistant principal had something to do with stopping the attack. And only 10 of the 13 mentioned they actually used a gun to stop the attack. 8 of those 10 news stories were in local media near where the attack had occurred. 2 of them were on national news, but one was on ABC World News Now at 4 a.m. in the morning, and the other one was on CNN Early Prime about a two-sentence mention the day after the attack. So, and just give you another quick example. A few years ago, there was an attack at the Appalachian Law School in Virginia in which 3 people were killed. There were 2 students who were outside the school when the shot started. They ran to their cars, got their permit concealed handguns, came back, pointed their guns at the attacker, ordered him to drop his gun. When he did so, a 3rd student tackled him, and the 3 of them held him there for over 11 and a half minutes before the police arrived. Now, again, if you do a news search, you can see the same type of distribution. You have about 280 stories mention the attack in the week after. Only 3 of them, all of them local, mentioned that the students used their guns. And so what I decided to do after that, when I was writing my book, The Bias Against Guns, was to call up reporters just to find out, did they know about the facts? If they did, why did they decide to write up the story the way they did? Because the stories would be things like, and the students pounced on the attacker and held him until police arrived, or the students subdued the attacker, not mentioning that the students had used their guns to do it, which in some sense I think was pretty important, because you're somehow giving people the impression that unarmed students were running up against an armed guy and succeeding in tackling him, which may not be the best advice to go and give people. And so, like Maria Glad, a reporter at the Washington Post, I asked her about this, and she said, well, the reason why she only mentioned that they had tackled the student and not mentioned that they had a gun was because she only had 913 words for the story and didn't have enough space to get into it about the students using their guns to stop the attack. And in fact, she had interviewed one of the students who had used their gun to stop the attack. I talked to one of the students on a radio show, Larry Elder, used to have a national radio show, and he had Tracy Bridges, one of the students, on with me on the air. And Bridges said that the day of the attack, he had been interviewed by like 50 different news outlets. And being a law school student, he had checked to see what quotes, you know, just normal human interest. And he was amazed that nobody, all these people had interviewed him, or the other student who had done it, and they just didn't quote him or have him in the stories the next day on the incident. And so I'd call up other reporters, and I, reporter after reporter basically told me the same thing that the person in the Washington Post had done, and that was they just had space constraints that they couldn't get into the details there. But, you know, they'd have like two paragraphs on the gun that was used by the attacker. And to me, the interesting thing is there, you know, the first explanation I gave you about why it's understandable the media might not cover certain things, saying, well, it's kind of more bloody or more unusual the situation is, the more likely it's going to get covered. But here, if anything, the situation's reversed. What's more likely to go and grab people's attention that they're going to think it's unusual to say the students used their gun to stop the attacker or to say that they just subdued them? My guess is you'd get more interest in the news story if they had gone through more detail on it. Now, finally, I think from talking to Washington Post reporters, given that they're relatively close to the crime there, when the trial went on and what have you, they went into detail at that point about the students using their guns to stop the attack. But, you know, that was well after the initial rush of publicity. And I can give you just one other example on this, and that is when I was doing the bias against guns, I noticed I accidentally collected 10 stories during 2001 of young kids, 8, 9, 10 years old, who had used their guns to save the life of a family member from some crime that was occurring. Often very dramatic stories. And I noticed that these stories tend to be small stories buried in the back of the newspaper, and that they never got picked up on AP. You know, whereas you would see something like a taxi cab driver by the same reporter in, let's say, South Bend, Indiana, who had been killed, and some years being a taxi cab driver is the most dangerous profession in the United States. And they had been picked up in 28 newspapers. So I called up the reporters for these 10 stories, and I asked them, you know, why is it that these other crime stories you've written get so much more attention, but these cases of these young kids don't? Like, so the South Bend, Indiana case was an instance where the boy's mother was a drug addict. She left the scene. She had dated a gang leader, told the gang leader that the grandmother who was taking care of her son had money and jewelry at the house. The gang leader went over, stabbed the grandmother in the stomach, had a box cutter knife to her throat, and was threatening to kill her, demanding that she tell him where the money and jewelry was. She felt she was going to get killed as soon as she told him. Her grandson, the father, had died a year earlier from cancer, but before he had died, he had taken the grandson, or taken his son out and showed him how to shoot. Got the grandmother's gun, came down, and fatally shot the gang leader in the chest. Now, that got 250 words in the back of the paper there. And I was saying, you know, it seems that that should have been a big story.
Yeah, and look at all the money it saved the taxpayers.
Right. But the reporter told me something that the other reporters did, and that was, well, you know, she was very concerned about accidental gun deaths involving kids, and she and the editors there had felt that if they put it in too much of a positive light with children and guns, then maybe people out there would let their kids get access to guns and let them use them, and then that would result in more accidental deaths involving kids, and that then they would be responsible for those deaths. Now, I didn't really get into an argument with her about these things, but something like accidental deaths involving, you know, here we had a 10-year-old kid, take accidental deaths involving kids under 10, you're talking about in a typical year someplace between 20 and 30 accidental gun deaths for all the kids in the United States under 10. I think the most recent numbers for under 15, you're talking about like 52. So those are, it'd be better if it was zero, but my guess is they're a lot less than these reporters think that they are. And even if you look at the ones under 10, about two-thirds of those deaths are not from a child shooting the gun. Two-thirds of them are from an adult male with a criminal record in his late mid to late 20s. So this isn't even relevant. But it's the perception. So here you have a situation where reporters have kind of convinced themselves that they're doing the right thing to kind of control the information out there on these things. But it just snowballs because, you know, you don't hear about these kids doing these heroic things, and so the next time they have a heroic story, they're even less likely to report it, and they over-report in some sense in terms of the amount of coverage because these accidental gun deaths, because there you see hundreds of stories across the country on each accidental gun death involving a child. You compare it to any other way that children die, and it's much more heavily covered. I mean, you have more kids under age 5 drowning in 5-gallon plastic buckets than you have children under age 10 who die from accidental gunshots. But yet, you would never know that from the news coverage.
Maybe we should outlaw buckets.
Well, maybe. But buckets do good things, and they also can cause some bad things sometimes. Bathtubs are the same way. You have about 90-some kids a year under age 5 who drown in bathtubs each year. But presumably we're not going to ban bathtubs. And I guess I would just say there's similar trade-offs for guns and that, you know, there are costs and benefits for all these things. And I think people kind of overestimate in their mind because of the news coverage the cost for some of these items more than others.
Absolutely true. Let me take a brief pause. We'll be back in just a minute.
Did you know that we offer one-on-one coaching programs? This includes 6 months of one-on-one coaching for only $4,997 for 6 months. For more details, go to jasonhartman.com.
We're running long on time here, but I want to ask you about one other concept, and I don't know that you've covered this, but when you talked earlier about the police coming to crime scenes and how it's almost always after the fact, the damage is done, the bodies are there, and the criminal has left probably, or they've shot themselves if it's a murder and then a suicide at the end. But one of the things I'm noticing, and this is not to say anything bad about our finest in uniform, our law enforcement personnel, but it's just sort of a general sort of trend that I see going on, and that is that police departments are in the business of raising revenue. They are in the business of giving tickets and doing things like that, and those easy things have no cost and they have all revenue attached to them. The reason I ask you this is because I was talking to a retired police officer friend of mine just last week, and we were talking about crime and so forth, and he says, cops don't make arrests anymore if they can help it. And I said, what do you mean when you say that? That's a crazy statement. And he says, well, there's just too much liability. There's just too much liability in arresting people now. And I thought, my God, it's like we've got a tax revenue generator, which is the police department, give out tickets and so forth, and they don't want to have liability of making an arrest and being accused of discrimination or brutality or, and I'm talking the good cops here that are good people, but there's a lot of liability associated with it.
What I can say is over the last couple decades, there has been a big increase in arrest rates and conviction rates per crime that's occurring. Now, we also have many more police now per crime, which is one reason why you have the higher arrest rates, but possibly you could have a drop in arrest per police officer but still have, you know, an increase in the overall arrest rate per crime that's there just because we have kept so many police at, even though crime rates have fallen. I think that's also one of the reasons why crime rates have fallen. You get some drop, you keep the same number of police going after trying to solve fewer crimes. You know, you solve more of them. And as you solve more of them, you make it riskier and more costly for criminals to go and commit crime. And so that deters more of them to commit it. And then you have even, you know, police going after a fewer number of crimes. And so they're even more effective at that. And so we've had kind of a snowballing effect to some extent over time with regard to that. But over the last couple decades, there has been a significant increase in both arrest rates and conviction rates. And I think that's been very important for helping to keep crime rates down. I mean, I'm sure the types of concerns that the officer, a friend of yours, is raising are true. And, you know, you could be, obviously the numbers I'm talking about right now are national. I can't tell you for every state that, or every county, that they all are moving in the same direction by any means. But nationally, I think that's definitely been the case. And so, and I will say that that's where police are extremely important. Police arrest rates impose a big cost on criminals, even if they're not eventually convicted, though that also poses the next biggest cost on them. But it does impose significant costs on these guys to go through the legal process, and it is a deterrent. So, you know, I think police should be encouraged to do it, and if there are things, and there's surely, I can understand, lots of legal issues that have to deal with that make it harder for them to deal with stuff over time, should be minimized as much as possible.
And just a note here, the person I was talking to was LAPD, and in LA, with between the gang violence and the ethnic strife and so forth, and the political correctness going on, and what's happened since the Rodney King thing, and every time you make an arrest, you're accused of discrimination, brutality. It's making it really tough for these guys to do their job. But anyway, listen, John, just kind of sum this whole thing up for us, and you've given out your website, so that's great. People should go there for more info, but any additional resources, closing thoughts you want to share?
Well, sure. Look, I mean, I think guns make it easier for bad things to happen, but they also make it easier for people to protect themselves and prevent bad things from happening. And there are a lot of good people out there, and a relatively small number of bad people there. And I think, in some sense, we should be thankful that people are willing to go and carry concealed handguns around for protection. I mean, I've been amazed that a lot of liberal groups are even upset letting police carry concealed handguns off-duty. I mean, here you have guys who have trained, who have spent their whole lives, know what to do with something, how to deal with problems, and they're willing to do it for free.
Right,
of course, because
yeah.
They even feel more comfortable carrying a concealed handgun with them when they're off-duty because they know how valuable it is. And they're willing to do it for free, and yet we still give them half over doing things like that. And the other thing is just the people who benefit the most from being able to have a gun, just generally, are the most vulnerable people in our society, as we talked before. It's basically people who are weak physically, women and the elderly in particular, and people who are most likely to be victims of crime. And I worry that a lot of the laws that we have, you know, in Chicago, they go and make you have to pay these high fees to go and now register a handgun, even though it's legal, and have to pay hundreds of dollars for these training courses and have to go someplace outside the city to do it. The types of people who they're going to keep from getting guns in those situations are basically poor blacks, the people who benefit the most from being able to have a gun to protect themselves in those areas. And you know, it's something that concerns me a lot, that these rules often end up making it so it's basically white, wealthy people who are able to go and get guns for protection, and not often the people who need them the most.
Yeah, very good point. Well, John Arlott Jr., More Guns, Less Crime is the book, and it's in its third edition. I recommend everybody go out and get this. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we want to have you back on my Creating Wealth show to talk about your other book, Freedomnomics. I can't wait to have you on to talk about that.
Well, thank you. That'd be great.
Thanks so much, John. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Now you can get Jason's Creating Wealth in Today's Economy home study course. All the knowledge and education revealed in a 9-hour day of the Creating Wealth Bootcamp, created in a home study course for you to dive into at your convenience. For more details, go to jasonhartman.com. Thank you for joining us today for the Holistic Survival Show, protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Be sure to listen to our Creating Wealth Show, which focuses on exploiting the financial and wealth creation opportunities in today's economy. Learn more at www.jasonhartman.com or search Jason Hartman on iTunes. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, offering very general guidelines and information. Opinions of guests are their own, and none of the content should be considered individual advice. If you require personalized advice, please consult an appropriate professional. Information deemed reliable, but not guaranteed.